Sunday, March 5th, 2023, Robert J. Sawyer and Tim Powers doing a Writers of the Future panel for the Greater Los Angeles Writers Society, moderated by Joni Labacki.
So basically, both Robert Sawyer and Tim Powers are judges in L. Ron Hubbard's Writers of the Future contest. This is a contest that is now in its 40th year. We have launched the careers of many New York Times bestselling authors, and you cannot be published to enter, which is why a lot of people love the contest itself. It's a fair shake, and Robert and Tim will tell you about that. They've both been judges for many years, and it's always a delight to work with them every year when we have our workshop and our gala award ceremony for that year's winners. Rob and Tim are always there, and they're always imparting their wonderful wisdom and knowledge to everyone at that conference. So,
which is coming up next month.
That's right. Yeah. We have an event coming up here soon. We also just did the cover reveal of that, of the book that we're going to be releasing at that event, which I will show you guys in a minute here. But first, let's get into Rob and Tim. Who would like to go first about your key go-tos on craft?
Wow.
Rob looks first in line there.
Okay, yeah. Sure. Well, Tim and I actually, it's interesting, because I write science fiction, Tim writes fantasy mostly, although we've, I think, both been in each other's territory occasionally. But I know that both of us are huge researchers. Before we write anything, we absolutely dig in and find out everything we can about the subject. You know, I once had one of my relatives at a family reunion, my mother's aunt, say to me, "Oh, what are you doing?" I said, I'm doing research for my latest science fiction novel. She said, "What could you possibly be researching for a science fiction novel?" And I went down the list of things, evolutionary psychology and quantum physics and blah, 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 blah. And to me, people who want to write, if they don't start off really digging into a topic, they end up being very imitative of things they've already seen. They do a knockoff, most commonly, of Star Wars, a little less commonly of my favorite, Star Trek. Very rarely a knockoff of Philip K. Dick and novel, not the Blade Runner and so forth, but the work or of any number of great science fiction writers. But they rarely have something interesting and new to say. And I find that I have no idea what I'm going to say when I start. I pick a topic, a very, very general topic, and I research the heck out of it, but I've developed an eye to be looking for things that can be dramatized, dramatically interesting things, whether it's a character conflict in the topic, whether it's a moral or ethical situation that the topic suggests. But you find your story not from staring into space and hoping something comes de novo out of your frontal lobes, but by digging into books, online, going places. Tim, I know, doesn't like to go anywhere. He sits right there and does his research with maps and everything. But whatever it is, either Tim or me, we start out by trying to know as much as we can about the topic we're going to write about.
Weirdly, we're very parallel. I didn't realize that. I never approach writing a story with a plot already in mind. I'll find an area, as you say, that looks rich in potential details. Pirates in the Caribbean in the 18th century, espionage in the Middle East in the 1930s, anything that makes me think, yeah, probably there's a lot of cool stuff there. And then I just research the daylights out of it, following every indicated side trail, picking up things that I think are too cool not to use. And when I've got 20 or 30 things that are too cool not to use, as you say, it might be characters, it might be a social situation, it might be some architecture, some war, some intriguing confusion, then I think, okay, what sort of story do these seem to indicate? And one handicap fantasy has that science fiction does not is everybody knows on entry that the events are impossible. Not just unlikely one day maybe with technological developments, but flat impossible. There aren't any ghosts, vampires, werewolves. And so I find it's real necessary to immerse the reader in the scene, the details, the looks, the weather, the clothing, everything. To trick the reader into thinking this is really happening in a real place to real people. I like to think that then, having established that, when I spring a ghost or werewolf or something on them, it will be as nearly as surprising and intrusive as if it had actually happened to them. And in fantasy, I think especially, more than in science fiction, there's a temptation to be, since it is all nonsense, to be flippant, to be tongue-in-cheek and ironic, in effect to push down the book between you and the reader and wink and say, we all know this is junk, right? This is nonsense. And to me, that's fatal. In fantasy stories, any sort of flippancy, tongue-in-cheek, winking at the reader announces this is all just fake. Don't bother getting invested in these characters. I'm just playing around with hand puppets here.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I want to put a capstone in one sentence for people on what we initially talked about, which is in a lot of MFA programs, and my editor at Ace Science Fiction, Penguin Random House, Science Fiction and Fantasy, said a few years ago, we have never knowingly published a writer who has an MFA degree because they are so misinformed about the realities of actually publishing commercial fiction. They may learn how to publish in small literary journals published by, you know, universities and colleges, but not the stuff that's on the shelves at Barnes and Noble. So in those classes, they tell you, write what you know, and that's crap. Write what you can find out about. And
yes.
Tim is, you know, I'm here as the junior judge. A, Tim has been longer, but P, Tim runs our writer's workshop that we give for the winners. And on the first day of that workshop, Tim has a box of curios and items, all kinds of interesting objects, and he hands one to each of the students and says, you've never seen this before, and you've got to think about it, figure out what it is, it may be obvious, it may not be obvious, and find the story that that represents. That is the journey. It is not, oh, you know, I was bullied on the playground, or, you know, it isn't that. It isn't what you know for most of us. Now, I see my great friend Amanda Potter, who is writing a wonderful memoir right now. Memoirs different, but for fiction, for most of us, the picayune minutiae of our lives is only of interest to us. What we're looking for is things that touch a universal. And we look for this as the judges, and we look for this in creating our own work. Who the hell is going to care about this is one of the questions that has to be at the back of your mind.
Yes.
Right. Yeah. Now, I have a question for both of you. When people enter the contest and you're actually judging that story, tell these people what it is you're looking for.
I'll go first again, Tim, if you don't mind. Because you mentioned when you introduced us, Joni, that I'm mostly science fiction. Tim's mostly fantasy. The first thing I have to do is set aside my natural reading preference and be absolutely open to good work wherever it is. And we're open. Science fiction, fantasy, horror, magic realism, anything that I call in highfalutin literary language non-mimetic fiction, fiction that is not just imitative of real life. In some way, it is at a remove from the mainstream experience. That's what this contest is all about. And so I have to take off whatever blinders I have and say that whole panoply is eligible for this contest and try to judge it fairly. That said, Tim and I and all the other judges are extremely well read, not just in our own little wheelhouse. I read all kinds of things that are not of my interest. Tim will be fascinated because we talk periodically. Right now I'm reading a book called An Introduction to Christian Theology, which would astonish Tim because of me being an atheist and Tim being a Roman Catholic, and we sometimes talk about our different worldviews. But the why we bring our take off our blinders and read as openly as we can, but you have to remember when you're in the contest, we're well read, even if it's outside what we write. So originality. We had a story that I still tell people about. It's one of the most original stories. Joni, you'll remember this. Tim will remember this. I can't remember which writer it was. It was probably 15 years ago, but it was about museum animatronic exhibits. There was King Tut and Abraham Lincoln, who had become, do you remember that story? I mean,
I
had become great friends and were having this dialogue. And it stuck with me for a decade and a half because I had never seen anything like that. And I have to say, this year, I saw some, you know, very popular on TV right now is the werewolf, the vampire, the zombie, standard tropes of fantasy. And some of the stories I saw were very standard. And then I saw, and I'm not going to give away anything about who we've chosen to win or lose or how I voted, but then I saw some things that really astonished me with their cleverness within what had been very well-mined tropes. But I thought, wow, here's something that's extremely clever in what could have been just another knockoff of a standard part of the science fiction fantasy list of leitmotifs.
Yeah, I agree that it is not only necessary, but comes naturally to put aside our own quirks and preferences. Though sometimes I will find a story is working under a handicap that way. I'll think, well, I don't usually like this sort of thing, but okay, go ahead. I have found often many of my favorites are the fairly hard science fiction ones. This last lot of judging, think my favorites were, what you would call Paul Anderson, Greg Benford type hard science.
Perfect for analog. At least one of our entries was perfect for analog, or as a novel for Bane. Yeah, absolutely.
I do think it's important to, as you implied, avoid trying to follow a trend. Don't try to say, what's selling right now? What's hot right now? I will write that. Because at best, you're at the tail end of a long line of whatever it is. And probably it's not what you would have instinctively preferred to write. Go ahead and just write what fascinates you. And if it happens to be fall into the category of some current trend, it doesn't matter. You're independent. For many years now, fantasy has largely consisted of what you might call Tolkien-esque. The medieval sort of kingdom, the Dark Lord, the magic sword or ring or what have you. If that happens to be where your obsession lies, if you happen to really find that the most compelling possible situation, terrific. But do be sure, to get back to research, that you know what the technological level was. Did they have mill wheels? Did they have decent steel? Did they have distillation? What was their currency? I mean, don't just say a gold piece. And again, let's see, a couple of my prejudices are, and I'll read them, even if they go against my prejudices, but I have a hard time getting into a story which is told in the present tense. George walks down the street. He opens the mailbox. So far, so good. But if it gets into any kind of action, George leaps over the sofa. The window bursts open. I'm thinking, I don't believe it.
This goes back to what I said Ginger Buchanan said about MFA. Very common in literary writers. You know, I've read many a novel of late. What did I just read by Celeste Ng? That was all told in the present tense. And I thought, oh, come on, you know, the and certainly in science fiction, fantasy, and horror, genre fiction, mystery as well, the other genres, past tense is the norm. But I will forgive, but it is, it does rankle a little bit. I agree with you.
I loved the Hunger Games books.
Yeah.
And they were all present tense. And after a while, mentally, you begin to correct.
Yes, that's right.
As sort of an advanced filter.
That's right.
But why force us to correct? Scott Card said that there is a literary form in which present tense is the correct mode, which is stories that begin... A priest and a rabbi walk into a bar.
Yes, joke telling.
Jokes. Present tense is the perfect literary form.
That's right.
I do want in a story to be picked up. I want to feel as if a remote camera has been switched on, showing me people, strangers. I want to really be convinced that it's really happening. I don't just want events to be noted, like a collision occurred when car A switched lanes and collided with car B. I want to see it, smell it, hear it. If you can do that, you've really got me. If I'm experiencing the story, I'm already 90% on your side. And as you say, originality, I want, it's hard to maybe do, but I want a situation I haven't seen before. It might be werewolves and zombies and what have you, but I want an individual perspective, which every writer theoretically has. I want to see that writer's way of giving me a tour of this. And basically take it seriously. Take the characters seriously, take their problems seriously. And I really, you'd have to be awfully brilliant for me to approve of a story which was very jokey, tongue-in-cheek, flippant, ironic.
Yeah, I agree with that.
It could be done, but it would be a bit of a speed bump to get over.
The truth is, speaking of speed bumps, so I actually, you know, obviously I'm a hard science fiction writer. The accuracy is very important to me. And Tim has mentioned even in fantasy, where it's things that couldn't happen, the verisimilitude and the grounding in real believable research is very important. But the two biggest speed bumps for me are unrealistic psychology and unrealistic dialogue. If I can say that nobody in that situation would ever have uttered those words, it's a showstopper for me. And if I can say nobody faced with that dilemma or that life crisis in the history of the human race has ever thought that or made that choice. So when people, again, I don't mean to keep ragging on the MFA programs, but when people ask me what they should study at university, if they want to be a writer, I say, oh, if you can't make any other choice, study psychology, because characterization is simply the act of dramatizing believable human psychology. Understand what goes on in here, why people are motivated, what their demons are, what makes them stay up late at night, what makes them defeat their own best interests, as we all do from time to time. You understand that, and your characters will be real. when your characters simply do what you need them to do to advance the plot as you have devised it, then it becomes, that's the very definition of a cardboard character. And for me, I don't think I've ever given a first place vote to something that had a cardboard character or dialogue that just, I could not imagine anybody saying, you know, not Han Solo, but Harrison Ford famously said to George Lucas during the making of Star Wars, you know, just because you can write this crap, George, doesn't mean we can say it. Right? He objected to the unbelievability of a lot of the lines in the script as written, and they had to work on them to make them sound natural. And of course, you know, ultimately they did. But you look at Star Wars as an example, as a perfect example of unbelievable. The I guess this is Empire Strikes Back. Have you ever had anybody say anything to you, anything that was earth-shattering to you, where your response has been to scream, "No! That can't be true!"
Right,
which is
right.
What Luke does when Darth says, "No, I am your father." "No, that can't be true!" Nobody in the history of, I know they're not Homo sapiens, because a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, but nobody with any normal, they're dumbstruck. They're like this. They shake their head in disbelief. They say, "No, my father is, you know," and they'll name somebody else. "My father is so-and-so Skywalker." You know, they don't, "No!" Yeah, it just, the film died for me at that point.
Yeah.
It died for me because I did not believe these characters. They'd become cardboard cartoons.
Right. A lot of times, a cardboard character, say it's a Darth Vader, a Luke Skywalker, a Frodo, etc., what they seem to be supposed to do is call to mind in the reader more genuine examples of that type. They hold up a silhouette, which is only two-dimensional, but it's supposed to remind you of Gollum or what have you. It serves the same purpose as a cliche, sort of expedite, get it past this.
Yes. And you can get away with that with a background character, a little bit of shorthand, right? Oh, yeah, this is essentially the Casper Gutman character from the Maltese Falcon, the nefarious criminal mastermind. I've seen that character a million times. I only need a couple of little bits of that because he's background. But your foreground character better be as complex and nuanced as a real human being. Yeah.
Yeah,
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, I find it's necessary when you're writing dialogue, say it out loud.
Yes.
Because something might look fine on the screen in type, but when you say it out loud, you think, well, no, nobody would ever say that.
That's right. Absolutely. And you also just hear the infelicities, not just the dialogue. I often recommend, especially to beginning writers, that you start with your manuscript reading aloud sentence by sentence from the last sentence. One sentence forward at a time. Then you hear the sentences, you don't get caught up in what the narrative is, and you'll hear that you've said the word thought four times in this paragraph.
Yes.
It'll leap
yes.
out at you, where you've missed it when you're caught up in your own drama.
Yes.
That's interesting. The two of you have literally, practically answered a question that one of our...
I see it there in chat.
But here we go. I'm going to read out here what Elman is asking you guys. He says, character or plot, which one trumps for wolf stories in your mind? Science fiction and fantasy are often mines of world building.
For me, a memorable character I always remember. And you know, this is in your real life too, right? When you ask if you ask me how I feel about Tim Powers, I'll say, I like Tim. Tim and I always get along. We don't always agree. We always get along. He's got a sense of humor. And then you'll say to me, well, tell me a particular incident about Tim. I don't remember. You remember how you feel about a person, right? You don't necessarily remember the incidents, right? Unless somebody has done something horrible to you, like put a shiv into your ribs, right? You know, you'll remember that. But in general, what you remember about people is how they made you feel. And the reason that series fiction is so common in science fiction and fantasy, whether it's Honor Harrington in science fiction, or you know, it's Katniss Everdeen in the Hunger Games series, is because you really like that character, and you're willing to go back and spend more time with that person. You don't want the same plot points necessarily hit, boom, boom, bam, bing, bink, as you saw them each time, that same rhythm. But you like the character. So for me, a memorable, believable character. And notice what word I didn't say there, which is likable. We always hear in creative writing classes, you have to like your main character. No, you don't really. There are an awful lot of characters out there that you don't like, but you're empathetic to, and they're believable. My favorite science fiction novel of all time was written by one of our now passed away Writers of the Future Judges, Frederick Pohl. Gateway won the Hugo Award, won the Nebula Award, won the John W. Campbell, Memorial Award. And it has a completely unlikable protagonist who is in psychotherapy for having done a really horrific thing. But he is so vividly described, and his motivation is so believable that you go, yeah, this is a book that, you know, that character, Robinette Broadhead, has stuck with me since I first read that book in 1977. But I couldn't tell you
I didn't like him.
Beat by beat. Right? No, he's not completely unlikable, but he's
But it's a real person you're watching.
That's right, a real person. Yeah. So, now, go ahead, Tim, of course.
Well, I find, as I said, I look for a situation that seems likely to provide colorful stuff. Recently, it was the Bronte sisters in England in the 1830s and 40s in Yorkshire. And I find I explore and map out and dig deeply into the situation, and then I kind of ask myself, what sort of character could most usefully be propelled through this labyrinth I've constructed? And in some cases, it's been an electrical engineer, a professional poker player, a rare book dealer, but my choice of the main character is largely based on what I'm going to put them through.
Yes.
What sort of person could most effectively be ground against difficulty?
Against. We're so simpatico here, Tim. We haven't talked craft very much each other before. This is fascinating to me. But I always say your main character should be the person who is most inconvenienced by your premise, most comfortable with, right? Which is why most action films don't work for me. Have this, you know, Liam Neeson, I have a particular set of skills. I will find you and I will kill you. Okay, I know that film. I don't have to see the film. The film literally writes itself, right? Whereas when you say, I have no skills whatsoever and you've kidnapped my daughter and I don't know what to do and I'm out of my depth, I have to find things within myself and the people around me. That's the story that you want to hear.
Yeah, in fact, when I'm picking my character, and once I've picked the definition, like he's an electrical engineer or whatever he is, then I want to trim him, sculpt him, so that there are some things he arrives knowing, how to do, which will be useful. And it might be unevident. He might be a professional puppeteer, but that will turn out to be useful, oddly enough, in the story. But just as important, I want there to be areas he doesn't know, where he's going to be a novice, a newcomer, and make mistakes and have things explained to him. Because, of course, technically speaking, it's very useful to have a character who needs to learn things because the reader gets to learn along with
him. Yes, absolutely. So there was a question that scrolled off on chat here, but I don't want to get lost here because it was something I wanted to mention anyways.
Which is, we're going to take a half hour with each question.
What's the average, the best word count? Joni will know off the top of her head, but I think we take stories up to 20,000 words, which is very long. Isn't it 20,000 our upper limit currently, Joni?
No, it's actually 17,000.
17.
That's
17. That's a big story. And for a beginner, that's a big project. And Kevin Anderson, another one of our judges, and I were talking about this recently, that what we find is that the shorter stories, the 4,000, 5,000, 7,500 word stories, are more often more tightly crafted, with every scene in them being necessary. And when we read the longer ones, we say, you know, those first four scenes, they could have been cut out. The story, whole thing could have condensed by 50%. So a really, you know, even though you would think a big story has more heft to it than a little story is much more likely to be a tightly bound body, a really nicely polished gem, than a big story. It's a much harder task. This is Writers of the Future. This is beginning writers. Now, Tim and I, we write novels, 100,000 words, whatever. That's a different matter. We're experienced at that. But when you're in your beginning of your career, if you can pull off 5,000 really polished, really good words, you're way ahead of somebody who kind of meanders their way through 17,000.
I totally agree.
The average, just so you know, we do have a bit of an average. It is between the 7,000 and 9,000 word. Those are what tend to, you know, get selected as the finalists. But the thing is that you really, the really key thing is it a really good, unique story? Just like you guys are talking about, is it original? That's more important than the actual word count. You know, I have people going, you know, should I make it another 100 words? Well, you stop on the wording. It's not how many words. Stop counting your words and write a good story.
Yes.
That's the key.
That's right. How good the words are, not how many words there are.
Exactly.
Yeah, a 17,000 word story presumably required all 17,000 words, and that would be quite an ambitious, enormous tale to tell. Certainly. I mean, science fiction, the whole history of science fiction literature has pretty much pivoted on the short story format.
That's right.
Yeah.
And even the most famous novels like Foundation are in fact fix-ups of a series of short stories. Joe Haldeman's The Forever War, fix-ups of short stories. Dune was an amalgamation of multiple works that were published in analog.
Right. Okay, we have another question. This one is, how important is physical description of characters? Some authors give us a picture right down to the crow's feet and sunspots on a grandmother.
Or a judge.
Others give a quick sketch and trust the reader to fill in the blanks. Do you have a preference?
I don't have a preference. And I'll say this, right? If I say to you, she was the most beautiful woman in the world, you have a picture, you have a picture, you have a picture. If I say to you, she had short cropped black hair and a long aquiline nose and a pointed chin and thin lips. Now that might, it isn't in fact, the most beautiful woman in the world to me, but it might be what the author thought of. And then suddenly I've lost the person. So sometimes it's better to leave it as an act of imagination for the reader, right? And we've moved past the idea, you know, somebody said to me, they were taking a shot at me on Facebook and said I have a weak chin, right? You with the weak chin. And I thought, we don't believe that anymore. We, you know, and I'm very good for people who want to practice their phrenology, because there's nothing barrier here. We don't believe any of that anymore, that there's such a thing as a weak chin or a strong jaw or, you know, evil eyes, or, right? We've moved beyond that. So it can be interesting, but there's this thing, I talk about psychology a lot in terms of writing. There's a psychological thing called identification, right? Which, you know, Freud identified it as when the patient starts to identify, you know, that the therapist is actually my dad or my lover or my mother, or whatever, right? The reader wants to identify to some degree with the character. The more physical divergence there is between me and the character I'm reading about, the harder it is for me to put myself in the place of that character. Now, that said, I also get pissed off at people who are just incredibly coy about ethnicity, right? I know it's a hot button issue, right? But I, you know, we have the natural panoply of humanity. It's a rainbow of people of different colors of skin and a rainbow of people of different gender orientations and different religious beliefs or lack thereof. And there's no reason to be coy, right? You know, people argue, they go back and say, well, you know, Ian Fleming never actually said James Bond was white, right? And, you know, if your character is black, African-American, we tend to not say African-American here in Canada, please forgive me, because, of course, they're Canadians, right? But so we say black is the politically correct term here. If your character is black, there's nothing wrong with saying that your character's skin is black, not to try and find some obscure way to kind of hint without actually saying it, right? In fact, who wrote Hunger Games? Colin, was that Susan Colin? No. Anyways,
Colin sounded right.
Yeah, she got in trouble because people, she had been so subtle that when they cast people of color in the films for some of the roles, people said, that's contrary to what she wrote. She said, no, actually, it's right in there, right? And Arthur C. Clarke thought he was being very clever, and maybe he was 50 years ago, when it's revealed that three quarters of the way through Imperial Earth, that the main character is African and has black skin rather than white skin, right? And it's, oh, wow. There's no need to be coy about it. We should celebrate the diversity. The way I look at that issue is, if it would be immediately blindingly obvious if this was a movie, why are you afraid of it in prose, right? If it's a, you know, the standard buddy cop movie where it's one black cop and one white cop, why would you dance around it for five pages if that's the reality that we would all see in 1/24th of a second, in one frame of film, if it were a film? So you can describe the characters. I mentioned Casper Gutman, who is the incredibly corpulent mastermind criminal in The Maltese Falcon, and also Sam Spade. What's very interesting is that Dashiell Hammett describes both characters in intricate detail. And when they went to cast the film, they cast Humphrey Bogart, who looks nothing at all like a blonde Satan, which is the description of Sam Spade in the book. And they cast Sydney Greenstreet, who looks exactly like Casper Gutman from the book. And neither, it made no difference whether they were the same or different in physical description. What mattered was whether they psychologically were the characters that Hammett wrote. So Humphrey Bogart, who looks nothing like Sam Spade, is the definitive of the three film versions of The Maltese Falcon, because psychologically, so when you describe it, I would much rather hear the peccadilloes, the inner hesitations of the character than whether or not they have crow's feet or blue eyes or green eyes or brown eyes.
Cool. Tim,
I want to, as I say, I want to put the reader physically in the situation, as if you could drop them into a movie, but with, in addition, air temperature, wind, textures of things. Therefore, I want the reader to see, ideally, everything. I would be real mad. Actually, I haven't read that Arthur C. Clarke book, but I would be real mad if he left me free to come up with a default picture of that character, and then in chapter five tells me it was a black guy.
Yes.
Because I then have to rewind and edit.
Yes.
My whole experience of the book, the movie I had constructed in my head is.
Yeah, invalidated, yeah.
I would like to.
Tim is freezing for me.
Yeah. Scott could do it. Okay, I hope I'm still live. 19th century novels apparently had the leisure to spend three pages with a hedge.
Oh, Tim is frozen there again, so I'll just add here. Absolutely. And it used to be, we've also moved beyond this, but it used to be very coy to reveal halfway through the story that the protagonist was a woman and not a man. See, I am very much against this notion of a default character, that the default character is a Western European-derived American white male of middle class, right? There is no such default human being. There are 8 billion of us on the planet. And that's, you know, a tiny fraction. So, you know, right in the first paragraph of a book, I will say, you know, that it's in the first sentence of The Terminal Experiment. Peter Hobson, a 45-year-old white man, was talking to his Pakistani friend, Sarkar Muhammad. And boom, you would have seen that in 1/24th of a second in a film. Why would I be coy about it? You know, and anyways, I've harped on that point. We can move on.
Okay. Well, now.
Oh, no, Tim, go ahead. Heart away, my friend.
Given that I want to give as many physical details, smells, sounds, colors, textures as possible, but I don't want to pause the action for some long paragraph in which I provide those things, I make it a rule, have the character...
Tim takes the dramatic pause to an excess.
Yeah, we definitely do. Okay.
Okay, you know what? We got to find the money here, Joni, in the Registers of the Future budget to buy Tim a better webcam. That's what we got to do here. Take him to Fry's if they're. Yeah.
Usually when that happens, the Wi-Fi connection, the whatever computer or phone.
Oh, yeah, we know. Yeah, absolutely, Tony. I see that we got lots of questions here, so,
right, so
go for it.
We'll move on until Tim comes back.
I can hear you.
Okay, good. We can see you now.
I want to say on the physical description, Tim will come back. Any detail, I think, you have a bazillion things I could be describing in this room. What I want is not just any random selection of the details, but the telling details, right? Now, for instance, I'm a science fiction writer. Isn't it interesting that the science fiction writer's backdrop is natural pine wood instead of chrome and plexiglass, right? That says something about me as a character, that I have a pine wood backdrop, right? That's a telling detail. Whereas if I happen to say, you know, any random detail, he has a digital clock, well, everybody has a digital clock these days, right? That doesn't make me more sci-fi that my clock is digital, right? You're looking, or not what you expect me to be, which is what we mean by a well-rounded character. So, you know, that Tim has a cat there is way more interesting right now than is the fact that I can see the corner of the SFWA address book on his shelf there. Right? You pick the telling detail, the revelatory detail.
We have
tons
of questions, apparently. We have tons of questions, so let's move on to the next one, and then because I want to make sure we just get everybody's questions answered here. The next one comes up here. In the Writers of the Future online workshop, in the last exit article, Hubbard states technical experience itself, technical expertise itself is adequate to produce an emotional impact. Which technical element do you think is primary?
Technical expertise itself is adequate to produce an emotional impact. I don't even know what that means, I'm afraid to say. Do you, Tim? You've taught that lesson.
Yeah, he does.
Yeah, does it mean technical in the sense of the machinery involved in the story, or?
No, you're writing. You're writing. Yes.
Well, yeah. You do have to have read enough stories to see, to have it become instinctive when to break, when to put in a beat between remarks, when to dwell at length, when to abbreviate, how to do an action scene that's visible but does not take 12 pages.
That's I get it now, yeah. In fact, if you've got, let's say, a dialogue between two characters, write the dialogue as an exercise. Write the dialogue with nothing. And then do it two ways, where they're having a fight and they're gently teasing. And you'll see by adding the pauses at various places, the body language that you'll put in, that's the technical expertise that affects the emotional impact that you bring to it. Whereas the straight transcript, if it was a court case and all you had was the transcript, you wouldn't be of the conversation. You wouldn't be able to tell if these two people were mortal enemies or were bantering, you know, potential lovers, right?
Right. And there are things like, in any scene, if it's two people talking or somebody fighting or people having dinner, whatever it is, somebody climbing a mountain, I try to have at least two things going on in that scene. If it's dialogue, I want something else happening as they're talking. Just so there seems to be more than one level of stuff happening in the scene. Also, I find it useful if a character says, "Fine, I'll meet you Tuesday at lunch and we can discuss this." Don't immediately go to Tuesday at lunch. Leave that appointment hanging in escrow for a while you have other things happen, because the reader knows, well, this is all very well, but Tuesday he's going to be meeting that guy. Sort of have some things, missiles in the air as things are happening. As one missile lands, you've still got a couple more in the air.
My metaphor is whack-a-mole, actually. That when you do something like that, lunch at Tuesday is a mole. You know, that arcade thing that they have at fairs and so forth. There's a mole has come up. And before the end of the story, you got to whack down all the moles that you've had pop up throughout the story. And a satisfying ending is when the whole board of moles has been knocked down, there are none left. And an unsatisfying, wait a minute, there's a mole over there. There's a mole over there still popped up that you didn't go and whack. That's my little definition of it.
Okay, yeah, good.
And this is all a result. This is all a result from having read a whole bunch of widely mysteries, nonfiction, science fiction, historical stuff.
Absolutely.
The Dickens, Trollope, Joseph Conrad, everybody, Hemingway.
Okay, cool. Thank you. All right. So here's the next question. When do you know it's
the world does not want to hear that question. The AI has decided that question should not be heard.
Very funny. Okay, here we go. Let me finish this question here. When do you know it's time to engage a professional editor? We all slave over our stories until we think they are ready. Many of us have writing groups and or writing partners, but there comes a point that a pro is the difference between good and ready. This could be for a given story or personal development.
I don't like the sound of when is it time to consult a professional editor. The way you interact with a professional editor is when you send the story to a magazine or a book publisher, because they have an editor there. It always strikes, for one thing, I think consulting a professional editor costs something. I don't think the author should ever pay something in the course of having a story published. Also, if I thought it was necessary, which I do not, I'd feel honor bound to get the very best professional editor money could buy.
And I'm booked solid.
If you're accused of murder, you'd have to get the best lawyer you could possibly get. No, I would say you write the story until it looks unimprovable to you. You look every which way. You think, there are no more places where I snag when I reread it. Now, of course, it's not perfect. It's just perfect as far as you could tell. But still, the editor you have look at it is the editor at a publisher. It strikes me as a needless waste of time and money to have anybody else go over it. I mean, I have two readers who read my stuff, my wife and a friend who's an ex-con. They're valuable because neither of them is a writer. They're both very well read, but they're not writers. I don't want to know what a writer would tell me would improve a story of mine, because that writer will be telling me how they would have written it.
Yeah, this is in the self-publishing environment that has emerged as a viable option in the last decade or two. This whole industry of freelance editors, especially for books, has emerged. And the reality is people are looking for a shortcut. I have always taken it as a badge of honor that my editors get pissed off that there's nothing for them to do. My editor at Penguin Random House Canada, Adrian Kerr, used to say, "God, Rob, I wish there was at least a comma that I could change to make it look like I'm earning my money here," right? You want to do your best possible job. And the thing about becoming a professional writer, the only value that I actually see in writers' groups and writers' circles, is at some point you will have a switch thrown in your brain where you're able to look at your own work with the same critical eye that we all so easily bring to everybody else's work. None of us have any problem at the end of watching a movie or reading a book saying, "I didn't like it, you know what I hated was blah, blah, blah." And we look at our own work and think, either we think it's absolute garbage, we can't see the merit, which is one element of the problem, or it's brilliant, right? And in fact, you have to develop your own critical eye. And yes, Tim is absolutely right. Editors are provided by publishing companies. We have Jody Lynn Nye, who is now editing our anthologies for us, right? She's our coordinating judge and the editor. Prior to that, it was Dave Wolverton. Prior to that, Katie Wentworth, Algis Budrus. We've had a great list of people who are the professional editors. So even if after your story has won the contest or placed in the contest, we'll say, you know, there's an infelicity here, there's a logic flaw there. That's part of the editor's job, and they will bring that to your attention. But you win the contest, or you get that very vanishingly rare slot in Asimov's or FNSF or Analog or Lightspeed or Clark's World, that they have, you know, occasionally room for an author nobody's ever heard of, because it's the names on the cover of the magazine that people have heard of that sell it. So you've got to learn to do that yourself. I would say the answer is don't. You don't bring in a professional editor. Now that said, Tim has a very small circle of readers. I have a huge circle of readers. I want to hear any criticism of my work prior to it being published. After it's published, shut the F up. I don't want to hear what's wrong with it. Yeah. I can't change it. It's done. Don't tell me you didn't like this, you didn't like that. I don't care. I've got your money.
Okay, so next question is this. As a reading reference that I might learn from, who do you think is one of the better writers of action thriller type scenes in fantasy works? I've got an answer. L. Ron Hubbard.
Yeah. I would add
Battlefield Earth. Oh my God! Though that's, you don't get more action thriller than Battlefield Earth or Mission Earth. Okay, you guys.
Hey, no, he's an extremely good, extremely good writer. There's no question about that. In fantasy literature, that's your bailiwick, Tim.
Well, I would advance Fritz Leiber right away. I think I've learned as much from him as I've learned from anybody, which is to say a lot. Paul Anderson. Well, you know, it sounds kind of cliche, but or infantile maybe, but I would say Robert E. Howard.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Conan stories, I reread them a lot.
Edgar Rice Burroughs too. Action adventure.
Sure.
And amongst our judges, Brandon Sanderson, who is one of our judges and, of course, one of the most successful writers in the world these days.
Great. Yeah. Thank you. These are great. Okay, next question. I sometimes find it hard to create character depth in short stories. I find it's not long enough to show character growth. Any suggestions on how to do this?
in a short story. So the first thing you have to recognize when you're telling a short story about a character is that this one incident is the incident that's worth exploring in that character's life. You don't take it random in the 80 years that, if you're lucky to live 80 years, that you say, eh, we'll take January 14th, 1974, what happened to the character on that date at random. So it has to be a point that is fraught in the character's existence. The character is facing high stakes. And there's a great nonfiction book called Story by Robert McKee, who is a very well-known Hollywood script-writing coach. And he says, in every scene of the story, a scene is defined by the change in the emotional charge value of the scene. The scene has to go from bad feeling to good feeling, good feeling to great feeling, or bad feeling to miserable feeling. It has to go, it has to ramp up, ramp down, or reverse. And you're looking at whatever your plot is not just a series of one damn thing after another. It's a series of events that constantly are moving that emotional charge level for the character. And if you do that, the character will have believable arc throughout the story.
Right. Jim?
I do agree. Also, I would say that every story involves a hard choice. A character being confronted with, I got to do this or this, and either one is horrible. The nature of that choice, I always think of Winston Smith at the end of 1984. You want Julia? Or not have your face be eaten off by rats. Ideally, the nature of the choice will be what crystallizes what that character is. He was in potential until this point, and then he had to be defined, like a waveform collapsing to a point. I always think that Abraham in the Old Testament was not fully who he was until he agreed and was just about to stab his son Isaac. That defined him. Up to then he was potential. After that he was defined.
Right, very good. Those are excellent. Okay, next question. If you had to choose one, which do you think is more important? Realistic characterization or masterful world building?
And I see that's from my great friend Amanda Potter. Hi, Amanda! to me, even when we talk about world building and we say the classics in science fiction, they're pretty shoddy. You think about Dune. Dune is a planet that has a uniform environment from pole to pole. It's a desert. There ain't no place like that on Earth, right? It has like one life form. It's got the sandworm in its various stages, right? It is not masterful world building. But Paul Atreides and his journey through that story is what made us follow that journey. And, you know, I'm a huge Star Trek fan, as you well know, Amanda. And we can very easily poke holes, you know. They say, well, they don't use money in the Federation, right? And then they go and pay for their drinks at a bar. Well, wait a minute. That's a complete contradiction. And, oh, by the way, they don't drink alcohol in the future. But wait a minute. The guy just got drunk. Oh, my God, right? The world building doesn't hold up at all. But we come back again and again and again for nuanced characters. And, you know, despite the pop culture perception, say, of the characters in Star Trek from people who aren't really immersed in them, the beauty of William Shatner was he brought everything he had to every single scene. He was totally invested in believability about what the motivation was of his character at every single scene as a properly well-trained stage actor from the Stratford Festival here in Ontario, where he got his chops. It's all about that. So for me, again, masterful world building. Tim and I both talked about research and verisimilitude and all that, but verisimilitude means the appearance of reality, not reality. Yeah. J.R.R. Tolkien tried to give us reality, and he spent years, tiny little details that really didn't matter, even to the readers of his stories. What you're doing with world building is, I'm a huge fan, as you know, Amanda, of live theater. One of my favorite things we do at Writers of the Future every year is a radio drama of an L. Ron Hubbard short story, which I absolutely love. And there's just a couple of sound effects and maybe one or two pieces on the stage that imply that we're in ancient Greece or on board a starship or something like that. The world building is, again, a few telling details. And you can get away with a lot with just a few telling details that fill in, that let you fill in the background. But the characterization has to be subtle, nuanced, and most of all, believable.
Yeah, you want to keep in mind the world building exists for the characters, not vice versa. It's the background in which we will get to watch the character, and it will provide challenges for the characters. But the story is about the characters, not the interesting world.
Right, very good. That's right. You got it. Okay, next question. I proliferate characters. We run into people all the time in our everyday. How many characters can a 17,000 word or less story realistically support?
Seven.
I very rarely have less than five and often have more than 20.
So whenever I write something, at the end I ask myself, are there any characters that can be combined into a single character? Yes. Many of the background characters who aren't, you know, complex and detailed, can be combined. The fewer characters, the better. My most recent novel is called The Oppenheimer Alternative, and I was stuck with the reality of all these different characters that I had to use, because they really were. There was this security agent and that security agent and a third security agent investigating Oppenheimer. And if I'd been writing the novel not set in a real history, that would have been one security agent. I would have folded them all in together. So look for where you can concatenate the characters and ask yourself, what is the role? Not the role as in, you know, I'm a farmer, I'm a doctor, I'm whatever. What is the role in the story? This character is the mentor. That character is the, you know, the wise sage. This character is the antagonist, right? You don't have four antagonists in a story. You have one. You don't have four protagonists. You have one. You don't have four mentors or wise sages or whatever. You have one. So you look around and you see what the role is, what the function of this character is. And if two or more characters are performing the same function, you roll them in together. That said, if they each have a distinct function, you say 5 to 20 characters and 17,000 words, it's not undoable, but they all have to have their own individual, specific reason for being in the story.
Great.
That's brilliant, especially see if you can't take two or more characters and make them, give them the functions of one somewhat busier character.
A way to look at this is the way a casting director does, you know, when they're looking at a movie. They'll look at the script and say, you got too many speaking parts. What can we eliminate and roll into here, right? And the same thing, they do the same thing, they look at the movie and they say, there are 25 different location shots in here. How do we get this down to four?
Yes.
That budgetary mindset also helps you focus your prose fiction.
Great. Okay, are there particular tropes or short story types that you feel you see far too often?
Oh yeah, the generic military space opera. Impossible to do something fresh with that. We saw in this most recent round of judging what I thought was a really clever werewolf story, which is very hard to do. But anything that's a knockoff of Star Wars, a knockoff of Lord of the Rings, which are, you know, the classic works, I see far, far too often. I'm much more intrigued when somebody has a story that's set in a seedy diner that turns out to be a science fiction story. Not that it's set on a spaceship where everybody's got shoulder epaulets with braid on them, and they all are, you know, and they have a first name, forgive me, David Weber, like Honor Harrington, and I know the story from the character's name. I don't have to read that damn thing, right?
Well, I totally agree, especially somehow in fantasy, what you see is pseudo-Tolkien. There's people saying aphorisms while waving ale mugs in taverns. There's dark riders. There's the Dark Lord. What does he do all day? What kind of newspapers does the Dark Lord take? It's, of course, it's possible to write such things effectively, movingly, powerfully, but they do seem to be all chunks of sausage cut off of one length.
Gotcha. Okay, cool. All right, next question. Do you feel a good story requires external conflict, or can internal conflict and human drama carry a story, in your opinion?
The latter is always more powerful than the former, in my opinion.
Ideally, you can accomplish both in the same story.
Well,
you know, Faulkner, when he won the Nobel Prize in Literature, said, the only thing worth writing about is the human heart in conflict with itself. And Stan Schmidt, the editor of Analog, famously said, that's one thing worth writing about. But if you can only write about one thing, that's the thing to write about. The human heart in conflict with itself. The beauty of prose fiction as opposed to film or live theater or television is you get into the character's thoughts. That's what makes prose fiction endure, despite the fact that we don't have a $100 million special effects budget. Right, but we still find more power in reading alphabetic words on a page because those words take us inside somebody's very conflicted consciousness. Should I do this? Should I do that? What's the right thing? Oh my God, I am, as for all of us, when it always comes down to my own worst enemy, right? And, you know, we spend our whole lives, whether it's, you know, through a particular movement, as Joni has found, or other ways, to control that, right? One way or another, we're all on that journey of trying to become self-actualized, to take control of our inner conflicts.
Yeah, and that does relate to my point about that fulcrum of a story is the desperately hard choice the character has to make, because it does involve the morality, the what have you, that the character has declared allegiance to, but now it's actually money on the table. Now it counts. Now it's forever. The choice does...
Yeah.
Is the human heart in conflict with itself? Yeah.
And, you know, these are universals, right? I feel I made the wrong career choice. I feel I made the wrong romantic choice. I feel I made the wrong dinner choice, right? These are universals. Having to climb Mount Everest or scale up the Eiffel Tower or whatever external physical challenge you choose to write about is not a universal. It doesn't resonate, but the internal conflicts resonate and find you a broad readership.
Great. Okay, so what are some of the elements that have stood out to you in the winning stories over the last few editions of Writers of the Future?
For me, I always, always, always am a sucker for, and Amanda's listening to this because she thinks it's my little dismissive comment. I say it's well written on a sentence-by-sentence basis. And that isn't dismissive at all. It is, it has to be, right? I can forgive a multitude of sins if I'm seeing prose being wielded well. And I don't mean necessarily in a highfalutin, fancy way, although that's very enjoyable. I love reading, say, Victorian fiction, as Tim alluded to a few minutes ago. But I can read absolutely pellucid, beautiful prose, you know, and I often contrast Isaac Asimov, who's clunky, and Arthur C. Clarke, who is beautiful, and yet they're both, you know, probably at the Fleisch Kincaid grade 6 level of writing, you know. Very simple, straightforward prose, but one of them does it where it's really enjoyable to read, the other one you go, oh, Isaac, I know you wanted to have 500 books in your lifetime, but it would have been better if you had 490 and it actually polished a little bit.
I guess I look for something you could call wit, but I don't mean humor. I mean a kind of deftness of narration, some sharp edges, believability, not the default dialogue, but quirky, sparky dialogue that sounds like something somebody in front of you might say. Basically, it comes down, I think, to have you read a whole lot?
Yeah.
Because you'll pick up grace, deftness from it. I want to be involved with the characters, but later I want the impression that the writer knew what they were doing.
Yeah.
When I'm in the story, I'm not thinking about the writer at all.
Yeah.
I'm thinking about the characters.
Right, of course. Yeah. Okay, do you have a preference of perspective?
So I tend to think what we call limited third person is the default for genre fiction. That is one character point of view per scene, and you're in only that character's head. So if I was writing this scene, I would know that I'm thinking, you know, Joni, we were supposed to end 18 minutes ago, and Carolyn, you know, wants to watch the end of Everything Everywhere All at Once that we started last night. That's what I'm thinking. But all I know is that Tim is thinking, thank God Rob said that. I can see that in his eyes, right? So, you know, my perspective, but not Joni's, who's thinking, I've got two of my best judges here who are dispensing gold to the masses. We can go forever with this, right? So one character per scene, per point of view, and the third person tends to work better than first for two reasons. Not that first is necessarily wrong, but it should be a deliberate choice. First works better, a third works better than first because one, first sounds like bragging, right?
Yeah.
You know, I went into the room and there were three tough guys, and even though I was frightened, I beat the crap out of them.
Yes.
It sounds like braggadocio.
I find you irresistible, she said.
That's right. And the second reason is a first person narrative tips off that character survived to tell the tale at the end of the story, right? That's why Ishmael and not Ahab is the narrator of Moby Dick, because Ahab couldn't be, because he dies at the end, and Ishmael, I alone survived, right, to tell the tale.
Yeah, I agree. Third person, one point of view. And one thing to keep in mind when you write that is your viewpoint character is the camera. Don't show us things that character couldn't see. I'm always thrown out of a book if the character is in a room and it's that character's point of view and thoughts, and you tell us what kind of car pulled up out front. I think he can't see that. Only give us the sensory impressions your point of view character is going to get, which of course means choose your point of view character carefully because you want the camera where stuff's happening.
Exactly. I can say in third person, if the third person narrator is Robert J. Sawyer, he raised his eyebrows. I can't say there was a vein pulsing in his forehead because I'm not aware of that, right? But I might see that on another character. So it's very subtle. And these things have an incredible amount to do with that psychological identification. Anything can blow that. Anything can break that where you have become the character. And you have to be incredibly attentive.
Awesome. This is all great. Okay, so I have something to share with everyone, and then we will be ending this. But the other day, we had the big reveal of the of volume 39, and I wanted to show the people here, because what many people may not know is you can actually pre-order the book right now, which we would like everyone to do, of course. Go to your favorite bookstore and pre-order it now. But let me show you. I'm going to give you.
Yeah, it's just gorgeous. Who did that, Joni? Which one of our
artists? Tom Wood.
Oh, yeah. Tom yeah.
Wood. I'll do a little close-up here. You can look at the details of his
writing. Yeah.
Look at that. Isn't that beautiful?
Yeah.
And there you go. I'm panning down here. That's the cover of the book, guys.
And, very cool.
Yeah, it's... So obviously, it's this year's winners, and we have a story by Kevin J. Anderson. In fact, that cover was done. The cover of the book is Kevin's story, and then we have Lazarus Chernick has an article in there, as does Christine Catherine Rush, as does S.M. Sterling has a story. So
who
there you go.
Our newest judge, S.M. Sterling, the great alternate history and military SF writer. Yeah,
that's right. So everybody, go to your favorite bookstore now and pre-order the book, and you can see what is winning. That is the other key thing that we always recommend, is that get the book. My goodness, it's you need to get the book so that you can read and see what's winning. What is winning this contest? Then you'll know. So there you go. Well, I think we're done for now. Oh, I see a beautiful cover. Can't wait to get it. There we go. That's lovely. Thank you, Mr. Sawyer, Mr. Powers.
Thank you, Joni. Thank you, Rob. Thank you, Tim.
Look at
Thank
all
you,
this.
Tony. Lovely. Always a pleasure,
really
Tony.
Appreciate it.
Yeah.
Oh, I hope we can do this more often. And
in person.
Lovely. Lovely.
And in person. Before we leave, I want to mention to our audience, this was brought together by Joni Labaki and everybody at Writers of the Future. But this is a part of a conference. Got to get my little plug in here too, that you are people are still able to take advantage of. Let's see if I got the right screen up here, and that will be being held this week, and is virtual with all the education in order to learn how to work on characters, plotting and pacing, world building, all that kind of good stuff. And then next week, we are in person at the Embassy Suites, just south of LAX Airport, and there'll be the second half of the conference. And there, we will, let's see, I got an event overview thing. Pop that up real quick here. We will have editors and agents there that weekend who will be taking pitches and consulting with all of our writers. So if you're in Los Angeles, or if you can make it to Los Angeles, we encourage you to go to wcwriters.com /CCWC and see all the different dozens and dozens of topics we're going to have. And, Joni, is it okay to mention we got a little giveaway next weekend?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Futures are going to be given away at the conference to those who attend in person.
Lovely.
Just like some previous seasons, we want you to go for the new season, but buy the new season. But we're going to have some books of the previous season that will be a part of the swag bag, reusable swag bag with all kinds of goodies in it. And we hope as many as you can join us for that event. I know we've answered as many questions as we can, and we've taken a great amount of your time up, gentlemen. And of course, Lady Labaki.
Lady Labaki.
Thank you.
Sir Tim.
Gonna be a new song around here. So we'd like our audience to put their hands together and give everybody a nice round of applause here.
Thank you, Rob. Thank you.
Well, we'll see you guys next month. And take care. Live long and prosper, everybody. And go to writersofthefuture.com for the rules.
Ceremony. One more time.
writersofthefuture.com. Check it out.
Yeah. Thank you.
Good night, everybody.